Welcome to the Gong Show Hockey Podcast, discussing news and topics from around the NHL and beyond. Welcome to the Gong Show Hockey Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Zach, recording on a Thursday evening before the puck drops on either of the games tonight. So bear that in mind as you're listening. We don't know those results yet. It could drastically alter the outlook, but here I am with an episode anyway. And the playoffs are well underway, and as usual, round one is not disappointing. We may still be in early days, only two games into most series, with the notable exception of the Boston-Toronto series, which is at three games. But there have been plenty of fantastic games to watch. I've tried to catch as many as I can. I hate that the Western Conference games seem to be far later than I'm able to stay up and watch the entirety. But as the playoffs go on, I'll probably make more and more of a concerted effort to make sure I don't miss those, or at least miss any part of those. And I gotta say, so far, my favorite series to watch has been the Florida-Tampa series. Those games have been very tight, and both games have been filled with physicality and chaos. Maybe more than any other series, both teams are finishing every check, scrapping after the whistle, and just generally trying to make their opposition miserable. Going into this series, I had playstyle and special teams as the key factors in this series. And so far, it's been pretty apparent, at least to me, that the Florida Panthers have largely been forcing the Lightning to play their style of game. The extreme physicality, finishing every check, and chippy nature of the game is a highlight of how Florida likes to play playoff hockey. That's not to say Tampa can't play that way, or that Tampa hasn't had parts of the games where they've dominated, but by and large, the Panthers have dictated the style of play. And I think that's a big reason why we're looking at the Panthers holding a 2-0 series lead at the time of recording. As far as the special teams battle, it just hasn't been a difference maker yet. Arguments about playoff penalty calls aside, because I don't think that would be fruitful, things have been pretty equal as far as the penalties drawn and penalties taken. Florida has spent 16 minutes in the box while Tampa has spent 14, but as far as converting on their chances, the power play has been a push, with both teams popping two power play goals each. In order to claw their way back into the series, Tampa is going to need to tilt the special teams battle in their favor. But that's much more easily said than done, because boy oh boy is playoff Bobrovsky back with a vengeance. That's not to say Vasilevsky hasn't been excellent. He definitely has been, and he's playing at an elite level, but especially in that game too, Bobrovsky came up with the otherworldly difference-making save. That diving backward glove save was the difference maker in that game. And Vasilevsky will have those moments at his end too as this series goes on. And he had some 10 bell saves in game two. It's just that Bob had the biggest one and his team won the game. Now with the series shifting to Tampa tonight, they're going to have the last change after stoppages. With that usually comes the ability to better dictate the style of play. So we'll see if Tampa can swing the momentum of the series. But one more loss puts them in serious danger, despite having played pretty decently so far this series. Now, by the time you're listening to this, Game 3 will be in the books, and the Panthers will either be one game away from the sweep, or the Lightning will be one game away from tying the series. For entertainment purposes, I'll go ahead and make a prediction here so that you can all point and laugh at me, but I'm going to say Tampa Bay wins tonight 4-2. The other thing in this series that is becoming clear is that this is a war of attrition, and whichever team wins it looks like they will be banged up for round two, likely more so than whichever of Toronto or Boston moves on from that series. And to that point, Sam Bennett will miss at least a week after taking a Brandon Montour shot to the hand. It's not a series-altering loss by any means, but this series is so ultra-tight and Bennett plays such an important role on the Florida Panthers, it very well could end up making a difference in games 3 and 4 at a minimum. Moving on to our other Atlantic team matchups, we have the Bruins and Leafs series, which has been another great watch. There has been physicality and chippiness to be sure, but the games have been chock full of mistakes by both teams. Defensive lapses, stupid passes, and incredibly untimely penalties. Right now, it's Boston that's made fewer mistakes or capitalized more on Toronto's mistakes up to this point in the series, but at this stage, both teams are so evenly matched and so prone to mistakes on the ice that this series could still comfortably go either way. Although I will definitely say it is trending toward being a 7-game series once again. I still think the series goes to whichever team can best tighten up their own game, but I think what we're seeing is two good teams prone to mistakes continuing to make big mistakes. The other big X factor so far in this series has been the absence of William Nylander. Apparently, he picked up an upper body injury in the last game of the regular season and has been conspicuously absent from the Leafs in the first three games. Now, he has been skating, and so it's felt like he was sure to play in Game 3, but apparently he was unable to go. That's a huge missing piece from the Leafs. I mean, after all, over the last few years, he's been their best playoff performer, and no doubt about it, missing him has hurt them a lot in this series so far. You have to think that he's going to be back for Game 4 under almost any circumstances. You just have to. The Leafs need him, and if he comes back, he could swing the series in their favor. One other thing to continue to keep an eye on here is the goalies. The Bruins started Swayman in Game 1, and he was excellent, and then started Ullmark in Game 2. And the decision to stick with their regular season goalie rotation drew a lot of criticism from pundits around the league, much like last playoffs when the Wild chose to start Fleury instead of going back to Gustafsson, a move which may have ultimately cost them their series. But for Boston, it's not even remotely the same situation. Boston's biggest strength is probably their goaltending tandem, and I thought Ullmark was phenomenal in Game 2. He just didn't get the help he needed from his team. I wouldn't be surprised one bit to see Boston go back to Ullmark on Saturday. I think at this stage, altering from that rotation could get in their heads, or at the very least, throw off that kind of symbiotic goaltending tandem that they have. In fact, the way Boston handled their goalies last season probably played a decent role in their first round exit. The Bruins started Ullmark the first 6 games only to go to Swayman in that crucial Game 7 with all the pressure on him. And at the end of that series, both their goalie stat lines were awful, a far cry from where they were during the regular season. This time around, you've gotten quality starts from both. I'd go back to Ullmark for Game 4, and unless he totally implodes, I'd continue to alternate. It's what those goalies are used to, and it keeps them fresh for their next game. It sort of looks to me like the Leafs and Bruins are going to keep trading games. Leafs win Game 4, Bruins win Game 5, Leafs win Game 6, and that could set up a scenario where the Leafs and Bruins face off in a Game 7 where it's Swayman's turn to start and the Leafs have yet to beat him. Now that's all in the realm of prediction, and at this point there's plenty of hockey between now and then, but my ultimate point is that until one of those goalies gives you a bad start, I think you got to continue the rotation. I do also wonder in the Leafs net if the Leafs will finish this series with Samsonov in their crease. He was good in Game 2, but he let in a bad goal in Game 3, and he wasn't great in Game 1 either. At what point do you consider going to Wall? I know his regular season was marred with an injury, and he hasn't been quite as good since returning from that injury, but I thought he was their best goalie last playoffs. And I think that could very well be the case this year as well. Maybe it's too soon to yank Samsonov, but he's on a short leash in Game 4 if I'm the coach. If he has another bad performance, I'm thinking I go back to Wall in Game 5. Now, if the Atlantic series have given us tight games so far with the potential for 6 or 7 game series, the Metropolitan Division teams have largely given us the opposite. Now, maybe that's unfair to the Islanders because in Game 2, they looked like they were destined to win before the Canes scored a late equalizer with the goalie pulled and then scored the go-ahead goal only 9 seconds later. But the Canes look like they're going to run away with this series unless something drastic happens. Now, there is a chance that something drastic has already happened because after leaning on Varlamov early, the Isles are planning to play Ilya Sorokin in net for Game 3. It's not that Varlamov has been bad, but after Game 2, it's pretty clear they need a difference maker, and Sorokin can be that guy for them. I think he's the better goalie, even though Varlamov has gotten better results, at least in the regular season. Another difference maker could be the absence of Brett Pesce on the Canes' blue line. It'll be interesting to see who draws in for him since he's likely out for the first round of the playoffs at a minimum. Carolina's blue line is still great without him, but maybe it opens up a little crack for the Islanders to get back in the series. Now, I will say at this point, it feels like an impossible uphill battle, but the old cliche is that you're not in trouble until you lose at home, and despite looking outmatched so far, perhaps a return to Long Island can help the Isles extend this series. That game is also happening in just a couple hours from now at time of recording, so I'll humor you with another prediction. I'll say the Islanders do get it done. They get a win 4-3 this time around. Probably going to be wrong, but there we go. Now our other Metro matchup is much more mismatched, just like we thought it would be. There is an enormous gulf between the Rangers and Capitals, with the Rangers going up 2-0 in this series with ease. Now the scoreline in Game 2 was close, only 4-3, but that felt much more like the Rangers taking their foot off the pedal than anything else. The Rangers should win this series in 4, but the Rangers look a bit like they're playing with their food in this series, and that could easily lead to this becoming a 5 or 6 game series. They need to buckle down or they risk letting this series go deeper than it has any business going. Historically, there isn't always an immense benefit to closing out a series in 4. In fact, that extra rest can sometimes turn into rust, and a team can come out flat in the next round. But the other side of the equation is that every game played is more wear and tear on your body, and another chance to pick up a playoff-altering injury. The Rangers need to show up in DC ready to take care of business instead of looking ahead to round 2, otherwise they could find themselves in a real dogfight. With that, we'll transition over to the West, and perhaps one of the biggest surprises of the playoffs, at least to some, is that the Golden Knights lead the Stars in the series 2-0. I said earlier that you're not in trouble until you lose at home. Well, the Stars lost 2 at home and are now headed to Vegas, where they need to capture at least one game to avoid the sweep. This series is a weird one. It's slow and grindy at times, where very little is going on offensively, and then all of a sudden there'll be a chance out of nowhere. But thus far, Vegas is playing far more polished playoff hockey and getting the timely saves from Logan Thompson, who has been pretty good in this series so far. Jake Oettinger hasn't been great for the Stars, and he needs to find his playoff form and fast. He was supposed to be a difference maker for the Stars. So far, he's looked more like a liability. Despite making a few brilliant saves, he's definitely let in some pucks that he should have. That same thing can be said of a lot of Dallas's players. One of their strengths during the regular season was the depth of scoring throughout the lineup, but so far, too many players have been very, very quiet. Particularly Roope Hintz, Tyler Seguin, Joel Pavelski, Matt Duchene, and Thomas Harley. Those guys are usually very involved in the Stars' offense, and 2 games in, they all have yet to record a point. That has to change in Game 3 with a desperate effort, because I think it should be clear to everyone now that playoff Vegas and regular season Vegas are nowhere near the same team. To add to the challenge for Dallas, it's unknown at this point if Radek Faksa or Mason Marchment will be available for Game 3. Both players left the bench during the third period, which probably isn't a good sign. So who's going to draw in for those 2 guys, and can they provide an offensive impact that the Stars so desperately need? Up next, the Canucks and Predators are tied up at 1 game apiece, headed to Nashville. Game 1 was a bit sloppy, and the Predators had every chance to win that game before giving up 2 back-to-back goals in a short time span. And in Game 2, the Canucks were hit with a major curveball. Thatcher Demko was and still is out with an injury, which has forced Casey DeSmith into the net. Now, I like Casey DeSmith as a backup goalie, but the drop-off from Demko to DeSmith is substantial. Of all the injuries to hit teams in the playoffs so far, this might be the most impactful one yet. The timeline isn't known for sure, and we've been told that Demko is week to week. and we know for sure that DeSmith will be starting game three. That could be a real problem for the Canucks because that gives Nashville a decided edge in the crease, which can help balance the skill disparity between the two teams. If Demko misses the remainder of the series, I'm not saying that the Canucks are hosed by any means, but it's definitely going to be an uphill battle. The Predators are no pushovers, and UC Saros gives them a chance every game. It's critical that in these two games in Nashville that the Canucks can steal at least one with DeSmith in the net and bring things back to Vancouver 2-2 in the series at worst. A big part of that is going to be Elias Pettersson finding a way to impact the game. He was so good during the regular season. He's been far quieter in the playoffs. They need him to play like the player he can be. Moving on to the Kings and Oilers, they are knotted up at one game apiece, heading to LA for Game 3. Game 1 was a solid one for the Oilers, but Game 2 proved that the Kings are dug in and ready to put up a serious fight after they gutted one out in a 5-4 overtime win. This series is turning into everything we hoped it would be: speed and skill, physicality and chippiness, and plenty of goals to go around. Night in and night out, these two teams appear to be relatively evenly matched as a whole, and everything still hangs in the balance. However, last game, it seemed like mistakes undid the Oilers, especially the misplay by Darnell Nurse. Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl can cover up a lot of problems with their defense and goaltending, but they're going to have to do a better job in their own end if they're going to get their four wins. On the LA side, I think Game 2 is the template for how they're going to win this series. Take your chances and get your goals, weather the Oilers' offensive attack, and have Cam Talbot get you that one extra save that you need to win the game. They may not have kept McDavid and Draisaitl totally off the scoreboard, but they did limit them to a combined 3 assists. If they can replicate that performance in Games 3 and 4, their deeper roster should help push them over the top. That brings us to our last series, where the Jets are even with the Avalanche, splitting the first two games in Winnipeg. After Game 1, I felt fully justified in my concern over Alexander Georgiev in net. Going into that game, if you said the Avs were going to slip 6 by Connor Hellebuyck, you would have projected a multi-goal win for the Avs, but instead, Georgiev was awful, and the only reason he finished that game in net for Colorado is that Colorado had their fourth-string goalie in as a backup because Justus Annunen was dealing with illness. That same illness very well could have been the reason that Georgiev got the nod in Game 2, and in that game, Georgiev bounced back nicely and the Avs carved out a 5-2 win, looking much more like the Avs we expected to see. Connor Hellebuyck, on the other hand, has looked very fallible in this series across both games. As one of the best regular season defensive teams, the Jets have got to tighten up in Game 3 or risk this series getting out of hand and fast. I have zero trust in Georgiev even after that second game. I think it's a total crapshoot as to whether he's going to give you a quality start on any given night. But as things stand, the Avs can pretty much score at will, and they don't need Georgiev to be anything more than adequate to get a win. It's too early to say if the Avs are going to run away with this series or if Winnipeg is going to bounce back, but I'm starting to get concerned with how Winnipeg is approaching these games. They just don't have the horses to go toe-to-toe with the Avs in a track meet shootout. They need to turn this into a slower-paced, grindy game that allows them to wear the Avs down and give them a chance to capitalize on the shaky goaltending in Colorado. But all that's a moot point if Connor Hellebuyck can't elevate his game, because right now he's not giving his team a chance to win. With that, we're going to move on to a few pieces of news before we conclude the podcast. And first up is the Sharks fire head coach David Quinn after a brutal season, going 19-54-9 and capturing dead last in the league. Now, two things can be true at once. David Quinn had a terrible roster that wasn't going to win a lot of hockey games, but at the same time, the Sharks were absolutely abysmal, and what's worse, they looked like they had understandably given up at the end of the season. The goal isn't competing for the playoffs next year, it's competing night in and night out for 82 games. They know they aren't going to win a ton of games, but they have to at least be in games. In a rebuild, it's not about the results, it's about the process. the process of building a competitive locker room that does the little things right. Whoever gets the job is going to have a tough assignment ahead, but also the promise of young, skilled reinforcements graduating to the NHL. That should start the turnaround. I'm sure the Sharks and whoever the head coach will be certainly hope that the first big domino to fall in climbing out of the depths of despair is getting Macklin Celebrini to help fast-track their return to relevance. Another bit of coaching news, the Sabres fired head coach Don Granato, and in his place have hired Lindy Ruff, formerly of the Devils, and a previous head coach of the Sabres during their glory days from the time of Hasek to the peak of Ryan Miller. I'm skeptical that this is the right hire, but at this point they clearly felt that they've tried younger, fresher voices, but that it's time now to bring in a more old-school, experienced voice. Now, Ruff didn't succeed with the Devils this season, but I think a big reason for that was key injuries, especially on the blue line, coupled with a lack of goaltending at the NHL level. However, it's probably worth noting that after his initial Sabres tenure, the hallmark of Lindy Ruff teams was a high-octane offense and lots of goals against. Outscoring your problems is not generally a recipe for success in the playoffs, but it can help you to get into them, and I would imagine that's the imperative for Lindy Ruff next season. Get the Sabres into the playoffs and end that long, long drought. It's going to be a tough battle, to be sure. The Atlantic is only going to be tougher next season with the top teams still hanging around, and the Wings, Senators, and Habs all looking to take that next step. This may be the first move of the Sabres offseason, but if they want to be a playoff team next season, it can't be the last thing they do. They need to do some tinkering on that roster, and as much as I love their young guys, they need some more skilled veterans to come in and bolster that group and get that team headed in the right direction. With that, we had a couple contracts that got signed that we need to talk about. The first one is Ivan Fedotov re-signing with the Philadelphia Flyers. Now, he's not a young goalie, having come over from the KHL. He's already had plenty of professional hockey experience. He's 27 years old, and he signs a two-year deal worth $3.275 million per. And on the face of it, that is a very rich contract for a guy that didn't look very good in his three appearances with the Flyers at the end of the season. That being said, the goaltending market is very weird. There is definitely greater demand for goalies than there is a supply of them, and Fedotov has some very appealing traits, most notably his size, that would make you think that he can be an NHL-level goalie, and a decent one if he gets to start the season on the right foot, has a chance to go through training camp, work with the goalie coach, and improve his game so that he can be a competitive NHL-level goalie. And I think part of the reason he gets paid is that potential, and the other part is all the hoops he had to jump through to get over to the NHL. The Flyers didn't want to risk him testing out the UFA waters and signing somewhere else and having it work out great for some other team while they're sitting looking at a tandem of, I don't know, Erson and Sandstrom or, hell, even Cal Peterson. So we'll see how it works out for the Flyers. Maybe erase that three-game sample size from your memory. Go into this with fresh eyes and hope that come start of next season, he looks like a different, confident goalie ready to face NHL-level competition, because it's got to be difficult to come directly from the KHL into a team that's fighting for a playoff spot and be expected to save them. That's just not fair, and that's a lot more pressure than he probably signed up for. So maybe given a fresh start to a new season, we get to see what Ivan Fedotov really is as an NHL goalie. Now the other signing is an interesting one. Alex Vlasic re-signs with the Chicago Blackhawks. It's a six-year deal worth $4.6 million AAV, and he's a young, up-and-coming defenseman, and one of the bright spots on a team that didn't have a ton of bright spots outside of Connor Bedard. Now, Vlasic is 23 years old, relatively young defenseman, but has played a fair number of NHL games up to this point, and what we've seen from his game so far is that he's a very decent defensive defenseman, largely playing on the second pair. He's a left shot, so he plays on the left side, and as the Blackhawks get more competent players, more experienced players around him, or more talented players, I guess, he should really shine in that role. He's not going to be an offensive dynamo. He moves the puck all right, but that's, you know, that's not the hallmark of his game. What you're getting him for is a second pairing shutdown guy that can let his defensive partner do more of the flashy offensive things, and you get him locked up for 6 years at a very reasonable cap hit, at least for a second pairing defenseman. So I really like this deal for Chicago. We'll see if they can be competitive towards the end of that deal. I think Hawks fans certainly are hoping that they've turned the corner by then, but I think if we've been taught anything by the Detroit or Buffaloes of the world, it's that rebuilds don't always or don't usually happen overnight. It takes time to get back into that competitiveness and competing for a playoff spot year in and year out. And adding talented young players is great, but that isn't an immediate or magical recipe for success. They still have to cut their teeth and find a way to win at the NHL level over an 82-game season. So a piece of good news for the Hawks, and they do seem to be moving in the right direction, and Vlasic is a key piece of that future, but let's not just say it's mission accomplished. They still have a ton of work to do, and they still need to add some more talented young players to their pipeline to help push the guys that are already there and to give them an injection of talent in the future. With that, we'll end the episode, but we'll be back in a week or maybe a little longer. I want to recap round one. We'll find out who's moving on to the second round and then talk about those second round matchups and who we think has the best chance to make it to round three. Thanks for listening to the Gong Show Hockey Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your podcast platform of choice so you never miss an episode. And please give us a follow on X at Gong Show Podcast.